Bill 2071A. And Megan, you'll explain the bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2071A authorizes cities to operate a pilot demonstration project to photograph drivers who fail to obey traffic control devices. It sunsets the authority on December 31st, 2001. Currently, Portland and Beaverton have been doing a similar pilot project. And the vote in the House on this issue was 35 ayes and 25 noes, and it does have a subsequent referral to the judiciary.
Okay. All right. And the first one is Troy Costales from ODOT. Okay, you go ahead and call it. Welcome. Won't we be doing this last night? Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Chair Shannon, members of the committee. My name is Troy Casales. I am the Transportation Safety Division Manager for the Oregon Department of Transportation. House Bill 2071 is all about stopping the tragic event of running red lights, which causes 260,000 traffic crashes around the nation each year, resulting in approximately 800 fatalities. This April, the Transportation Research Board, in their TR News publication, had an article about automated enforcement of traffic laws, which copied for you. And to summarize my testimony, on the first page, second column on the upper right-hand side, is a comment that this bill is all about. That automated enforcement of traffic laws is increasingly being used or considered by many communities as a sensible countermeasure for deliberate traffic violations such as red light running. Automated enforcement devices supplement law enforcement resources by being able to detect and provide evidence of these violations and reducing the frequency associated with motor vehicle crashes. This technology has been proven to work throughout the United States, particularly in urban settings. And with that, I'm sure I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Do you have one, Senator? No? Okay, thanks. Yeah?
Okay, that's all right.
Okay, thank you. Kevin, I do want to come up as a panel. I see a line driven.
You can, yeah, that's
okay. Oh, sure. Kevin Campbell, Jared Clark, and Lieutenant Kirsch. And then there's Mark Landers.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. First of all, I want to thank the committee for giving us an opportunity to come before you today to talk about House Bill 2071 and to express our support for it. Today, I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Law Enforcement Legislative Committee, and that means that I'm representing the chiefs, the sheriffs, the district attorneys, Oregon State Police, and the Portland Police Bureau, which is also here to testify specifically as they understand how this particular bill would work itself out in specifics. I want to be very brief, and I'll begin with just a personal note. In my written prepared statement, you'll notice that I've got the story here of Catalia Briley, who ran over a young man and killed him at an intersection. But I'd like to give a personal story related to myself. I lost one of my best friends to a red light running incident, and he was actually, his name was Ed Reed, he was killed at an intersection. He was in his marked police car, a Los Angeles police car, and the person who ran the light simply ran it and killed him. More and more, this is a problem. In the last 3 weeks, I've counted four times, because now I'm paying attention, that people have run red lights, not just yellow lights, clearly red lights, and it's becoming more and more trouble around the state. And so today we're here with a creative alternative to try to provide some deterrent to the number of people that are choosing for whatever reason to run red lights and to put people in danger. Let me just mention briefly a few of the components of the bill that I think are important and some safeguards that are in it that I think are important as well. First of all, the bill has permissive language. This doesn't require any city or county to employ photo red light at all. It gives local city government the opportunity to make a decision about whether this is appropriate for their jurisdictions or not. They'll have to weigh out the costs and the benefits, both in terms of financial cost and benefit, and the benefit in terms of reducing the number of fatalities and injury accidents that occur at red lights. Second of all, there's a requirement in House Bill 2071 that there be a public awareness campaign, that this needs to be done in coordination with some kind of upfront communication to the public about what's going to happen and to get their input prior to implementing it. Third, and I think this is particularly important to law enforcement, it requires that signage occurs as the person is approaching the intersection. Law enforcement is deeply concerned that we not be in a position where we are in a gotcha situation so that people that are getting tickets are saying, hey, I never knew. I wasn't warned. We want to make sure that the signs are there as a deterrent. We'd prefer that we never have to give a ticket, frankly, at a red light. And finally, there's an outcome evaluation that's required that would help look and see if this has actually made a difference. It does have a sunset provision. And when that sunset occurs, if legislative action isn't taken to continue the law, it will be discontinued as we know it. From a law enforcement officer's perspective, there's two reasons why this is a very attractive option to us. First of all, intersections are very difficult to enforce as an officer. You have to be able to see the infraction, the person running the red light. Then you have to be able to pull them over, which is oftentimes a health hazard to the officer themselves. They have to often follow the person through the red light themselves in order to pull the person over down the road. And there's no safe place really to put a police car to observe, since the way we have designed traffic intersections doesn't really allow for law enforcement officers to sit alongside of the road. You've probably seen them in parking lots and as such, but they still often have to follow the individual through a dangerous intersection, which causes that potential hazard both to the officer and to other pedestrians. Second of all, this is a very expensive type of enforcement. It takes a number of officers to do it well and to provide the same kind of deterrent that would be available through this photo red light opportunity. We would like to see more of the limited resources that are available for law enforcement officers to be given over to some of the calls for response that are currently either delayed or not being responded to as quickly as we would like because of the many stretching needs that law enforcement faces today. And so this would allow officers to address their attention more and more to the face-to-face responsibilities that they have for calls to action, whether it's any kind of domestic violence dispute, other dispute on the street, any kind of burglary, the kind of things that people complain about when they don't get a quick response from law enforcement. We think this does ease up the resource strain that currently exists. So with that, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I again want to say thank you for giving us an opportunity to come forward with House Bill 2071. I do have some other folks with me, some folks that are frankly more familiar with some of the details of how this would be implemented. And so I am willing to take questions now, or if it's your wish, if you'd like to hear from some of the others before asking questions, whatever your wish is on that.
Does anybody have a burning question?
I can wait.
Good. Okay, it's all right. Come on. I'm going to wait.
Yeah.
Okay. Go ahead. You need to move the mic.
All right. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jared Clark from the City of Beaverton, Assistant to the Chief of Staff. I'm here to speak to you a little bit about the specific need that Beaverton has for the red light camera and why we support House Bill 2071. With growth over the last 10 years, Beaverton streets have become congested. And with this congestion, it seems that there has grown a lack or disregard for traffic laws, and in Beaverton specifically, the running of red lights. Just to illustrate how serious this problem has become, I'd like to share with you some statistics that we have developed in Beaverton. over a three-year period from 1995 to 97, citations issued for running red lights in Beaverton has increased by 55% over a previous three-year period. Traffic accidents relating to running red lights has increased by 28%, and injury accidents related to running red lights has increased by 87%. I think what this points to is that the accidents occurring because of this violation are very serious and damaging both to property and to personal body. To complement these statistics, in three separate surveys over the past 5 years, Beaverton residents were asked, what is the single issue that you feel your city government should do something about? And in Beaverton, the consistent response has been traffic control and traffic congestion. Beaverton needs the use of the red light camera, and we support Council 2071 very strongly. The city administration is committed to making Beaverton City streets safe. Its elected officials, the mayor, and the city council all support the use of the red light camera, in addition to a citizen-led traffic committee, a committee for citizen involvement, and the Chamber of Commerce all support the use of this enforcement tool. Currently, Beaverton is implementing a red light running campaign. It's a nationally designed campaign by the National Highway Administration, and basically it's to educate the public on the dangers of running red lights. We've received funding from the Oregon Department of Transportation to administer this and implement this campaign, and we feel that it would complement well the legislation before you. And lastly, I'd like to just point out the fact that Beaverton has the experience to implement a pilot program such as this. As you know, in 1995, the photoradar speed enforcement legislation was passed, and the city of Beaverton and Portland implemented very similar legislation outlined in House Bill 2071. So with that, I'll conclude and just thank you again for the opportunity to testify today. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Mark Landauer with the City of Portland, as the Office of Government Relations. In that capacity, I also represent the Portland Police. Just very briefly, I too had a somewhat similar experience to Kevin here. When I was 5 years old, my mother was hit by a red light runner, and from 5 years to 6 years, the only interaction that I got to have with my mother was when she was laid out in bed because she had a very serious spinal cord injury, and fortunately she's fine today. But my recollection when I was 5 years old was watching television in Sesame Street with my mother in bed. So for me, this touches me personally, but putting that aside, of course, two of the major complaints that we see in the city of Portland, at least with the Portland Police Bureau, is speeders and people who are running red lights. And to just give you an idea of how many accidents we have in the city of Portland resulting from individuals disregarding red lights, we have approximately 1,200 collisions in the city of Portland alone that result from individuals disobeying red lights. 750 of those collisions result in injuries. 4 to 5 of those collisions actually result in a fatality. This is a major issue for the livability not only of our city, but also cities throughout the state of Oregon. I've asked Captain Nelson, who has been in our traffic bureau for a number of years, to come up and provide you some more detailed information as to why this enforcement tool would truly be a valuable tool in reducing the number of collisions, injuries, and fatalities, not only in our city, but also cities throughout the state. Thank you.
Thank you. What I'm going to do is temporarily close this hearing, and we're going to open the public hearing on House Bill 3531A.
Great.
And then we'll have,
so far we'll have you.
So we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2071A and open a public hearing on House Bill 3531A. Do you want to read it?
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 35A changes the appointing authority for the Director of the Department of Transportation from the Transportation Commissioner to the Governor. and it specifies that the governor shall fix the salary of the director and deputy director.
Okay. Welcome. Okay.
Members Shannon, members of the committee, my name is Mike Cleaner. I'm state representative from District 47 and a co-sponsor of House Bill 3531. Essentially, all this does is that it changes the duties or the control and discretion of the director of the Department of Transportation from the Transportation Commission to the governor. It is not meant as a means of usurping any authority or control there. It is simply another means to have that department respond directly to the governor's office. I believe the governor's office is in support of that move, though I would not in any way suggest that they're excited by it. I think it's a real important thing, but they do think that's fine. The objective behind it is that when you put the transportation department in the realm of things in the entire state, state hierarchy of what's being done, they're an important player. To have them answer to somebody else means that when important things come along as part of state policy, they may or may not respond directly to the governor. I will tell you, in talking to Director Klinikin, members of the Transportation Commission, the governor's office, they will say, as a rule, that has worked just fine. There have not been big problems, particularly since in the jurisdiction of Grace, that there's been a problem. The director, prior to that, there was an issue that cropped up where that director was not responding to directives or was not comfortable to responding to some of the things the governor had on his list and that the Transportation Commission did not. So I think that this is an important role, particularly when you look at the community solutions programs that are being put up where you're putting these agencies together with communities to do things. It's important that they all respond to the same person, be at the table, and not have a potential different boss to respond to. I don't think this is a big change. I think this is a relatively minor change. I don't think anybody is really worked up over this one way or the other. I think it's a good step for accountability and responsibility.
Are there any questions?
Yeah, good. What about the argument that, that this could make it more political in terms of, we don't know, currently I'm very comfortable with our governor's policies on transportation, so that would be fine in terms of decision, how he would be working with the director of transportation. What if in the future you had someone else there and you weren't comfortable with that person's policies on transportation? And so it would rely on the governor would have a lot more, direct involvement, whereas if it was somebody who's hired by the commission, you have a whole variety of people with all different political views on that commission. And does that bring a more balanced kind of view or assessment on who is going to get hired for that position as opposed to the one person who's in the governor's office?
Sure, Shannon, Senator Castillo, that's a very good point and one that's raised up. I realize there's only, I think the Director of Transportation is only one of a few directors that is not appointed by the governor currently. I would also note that in the current law, there is a provision that says that the director shall subject to the policy direction by the Oregon Transportation Commission. We left that in. We did not take that out. So specifically, he or she would still answer to the Transportation Commission in terms of policy. So there should not be a lot of that control over, particularly when it comes to roads and highways. You do not want this to become a political pork barrel process, and we try to stay away from that. Secondly, I would note that if there are major problems and a major disagreement under the current policy, the governor can always remove the members of the commission, reappoint new commission members, and then go through that process of getting rid of the director. So if there's a real problem, it would probably be even bigger under the current status. So, I think that is an issue and that is a problem, but I think everyone would agree, the Transportation Commission, the governor, and the director, that if there is a major disagreement between the governor and the director, there's going to be a major problem anyway and needs to be rectified one way or the other, and that probably this doesn't circumvent that terribly so.
Do you have a question or anything? But one thing, still, whether it's by the commission or the governor, then the Senate confirms.
Right. Senator Shannon, that's exactly right. You're a very good point.
Yeah. So, do you have any questions? Okay. And thank you. We talked about this before, but glad you're here.
Okay. Thank you.
We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3531A and open a work session on House Bill 3531A. You going to move it?
Well,
you don't?
Okay, well, maybe we better wait a minute. All right, we're going to close the work session on 3531A. We'll bring it back later. I don't want to waste more time. Okay. All right. Okay. Now, we'll go back to the public hearing on House Bill 2071A. Okay.
Senator?
Yes.
I had a question. I was wondering if at some point in the testimony there is someone who's going to come up and walk us through how this will work. Okay.
Good, because I was wondering that too. Okay. Lieutenant Ed Kirsch and Mark, are you Captain Patrick?
Captain Olson, yes.
Yep.
I'll defer to my rank.
Oh, okay.
No, go ahead.
We have room for one more. Mark Landauer, is he Mark? Oh, you were. Yeah, okay. Well, David Barenberg, you want to come up? Okay.
No, go ahead.
Madam Chair, distinguished members of the Transportation Committee, good afternoon. My name is Ed Kirsch. I'm a lieutenant with the Beaverton Police Department. I'm currently the program manager for our traffic division. On behalf of Chief David Bishop, I want you to know that our department supports this very important bill. If you've ever driven through Beaverton, you already know the traffic difficulties that our citizens now face. About 30,000 motorists a day use our city roads as a cut through to destinations, which usually is work or shopping. Running a little late for work or an appointment provides the incentive for pushing those red lights. We have over 100 intersection signals in our city. I can't give you the exact current numbers for the number of crashes at these intersections, but I can tell you that our engineers say that there's about 50% of these crashes that are caused by somebody running a red light. Our department now tries to target these intersections and encourage our officers to stop people who run red lights, but it takes multiple officers to safely work an intersection. It's not the most cost-effective way of doing business. As Mr. Campbell has already stated, that more often than not, our officers on regular patrol will not chase red light runners due to the dangers of clearing intersections in order to go after these violators. Red light cameras provide a safe and cost-effective way of holding red light runners accountable. They're just another tool for the police. Our citizens demand that we make traffic safety a top priority. They want the children and the elderly to truly be safe when they step off into the crosswalks at these intersections. The message our police department wants to send is one of zero tolerance. If you run a red light in Beaverton, you'll get a ticket. Red light cameras will help us deliver that message. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chairman Shannon, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to come before you today regarding House Bill 2071A involving the use of red light camera enforcement of traffic signal violations. For the record, I am Captain Patrick Nelson, Portland Police Bureau Traffic Division, and I've been involved in law enforcement for over 32 years. I'm here to support this bill. You've read the material that's been provided to you. You will hear testimony from others, so I'm not going to reiterate that except to make several points. Number one, red light cameras are a valuable tool that could be used to enforce traffic laws, protect the public, and reduce personal and monetary costs of injury and property damage that result from individuals disobeying traffic control devices. Second, cities such as Oxnard, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Beverly Hills, Santa Rosa, Fairfax County, Virginia, Charlottesville, North Carolina, and independent studies from around the country have shown that the use of red light camera enforcement has dramatically reduced violations, 42% and more at intersections where the camera installed and in surrounding intersections. Third, in this time of reduced budgets, increased personnel costs, increasing driving miles, and the traffic problems, I believe the tools such as red light camera enforcement and photo radar are incredibly important to the law enforcement, governmental jurisdictions, the transportation system, and all of the public that shares the roads of this state. Red light cameras are used in New York, California, Colorado, North Carolina, and many small communities around the country. These programs demonstrate success in saving lives, reducing injury, and the property damage. It's been my experience that drivers will ignore traffic laws until there is a consequence for their actions, and they need to understand that there will be a consequence for disregarding traffic signals. I believe red light camera enforcement will reduce the incident of red light violations and the subsequent accidents throughout the city of Portland and any other city that chooses to use this technology. Speeding and running red lights are some of the most dangerous forms of aggressive driving. Obeying traffic signals is a basic safety practice that everyone ought to follow. If we can't rely on other motorists to stop when the light's red, what can we expect on our roadways? Red light cameras would give us a measure of safety by holding people accountable for their actions. Thank you for your time and consideration. I'm available for questions if you have.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Dave Barenberg, and I'm representing the League of Oregon Cities. I feel quite at home sitting between these two police officers, especially since my house is on the Beaverton and Portland border. And I can confirm in terms of just the traffic issues that my colleagues have testified to. This is not the answer to curing folks running red lights, but it is part of the answer. There are other tools currently employed by police departments, education, enhanced enforcement, and other tools to try to reduce the number of red lights that are run. But more and more cars, more and more drivers, proportionately fewer police officers in years past, we really do have an epidemic of scoff laws that are just running on our streets, and we see what happens with some of the increased accidents that we all that are just epidemic in all of our communities. So for the city support this, the League of Oregon City support this, knowing that this is a tool that not a majority of the cities are going to utilize, but just some cities that are facing the hardest part of this problem. And it's something that the cities wouldn't undertake lightly in terms of just adopting. It's something that will have discussion, debate, often at the council level, and with public participation. So that what was being asked for today isn't the green light to implement this around the state, but it's for the opportunity of individual communities to make a decision based upon the traffic accidents, based upon the patterns of driving that are happening within their communities, and then being able to say, gee, is this going to work for us? Or and if it does, then move forward to adopt it. So this is something that will be put into place by several communities, probably not dozens of communities, but it is an important tool in those communities. And with that, I thank you for the opportunity to testify. And now let's figure out who we want to have do the walkthrough of
how this works.
Right.
The
right. And I'm not suggesting that.
Okay. Okay. Yes.
Dave, you may have the answer. What is the average cost of this installation? What kind of staff does it take to back it up?
That's true. We're going to get someone who'll give you a better answer than I will.
One question. I wanted to ask Jerry Clark from Beaverton, but I'll go ahead and ask the police officer. Right now, are all the lights in Beaverton coordinated?
I can't answer that as a matter of engineering. A good portion of the main thoroughfares are, yes, sir.
Okay. So you folks have Primet services the whole area, and you now have light rail. Yet I see that the accident rate, injury accidents, are up 87%. What's happening here?
Traffic volume would be the quickest answer for that.
So you don't see a shift to transit, even though the accident rate's up? And
I personally not seen it. It's too new. Light rail is too new, number one. And it seems to us that the ridership from the bus has transferred over to the train ridership. So that would be two answers.
A good answer. I was over photographing. I'm with you. I actually left people in the buses than I saw before. Mm-hmm. And that worried me that we have had no net gain to transit. I see a lot more traffic on the highways over there. Okay. Thank you.
Just in and
I have a question for the panel. I want to know what's the cost of the system and how is it going to be funded?
Chair Shannon, Senator Yee, if you'll bear with us for a second, we'll put up the expert who can walk you through the process and the cost.
Okay. How it's going to be funded.
Thank you.
Okay. And I'm going to close the public hearing for recess it for a moment. And we're going to open the public hearing on House Bill 2071A. And the Honorable Senator Representative Randy Leonard We'll talk to us.
He has a dual title.
There are other Zooms,
right? I think we have well, 2583. Yeah, 2583.
I think you opened 2071.
Well, I opened. Okay, let's just do it. We will open 2583A. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. It's a pleasure to come and testify my former colleague, Senate anyway, today. House Bill 2583, I'm going to speak very briefly soon, and hopefully we can allow these gentlemen here who are colleagues of mine in the fire service to get into some of the details. This was introduced by me because firefighters for the last 40 years or so have been involved actively in the Muscular Dystrophy Association raising money. And the Muscular Dystrophy Association is an organization that helps those with muscular dystrophy and also provides funds for research to find a cure for muscular dystrophy. They are very close to closing in on the basic causes of muscular dystrophy, and in large part it's the efforts of the firefighters throughout the United States that have raised money for this research that has helped MDA get as close as it is. They also provide wheelchairs and camp and all kinds of support for those with muscular dystrophy. House Bill 2583 speaks to an issue that arose just in the last couple of years with one aspect of our fundraising. We call it a Fill the Boots campaign. And for those of you that might be familiar with that, for instance, in Portland, we have a Fill the Boot campaign on Labor Day weekend during Jerry Lewis's telethon. And that occurs right outside of the Marriott Hotel. And literally, we coordinate with the city and the police bureau. And we get firefighters with fire boots, and cars come by, and people put in money. And they know they're coming down actually to do that. Put in a dollar, a handful of change, or whatever they might have. And at the end of that campaign, and we turn all of that over to the Annual Muscular Dystrophy Association. The problem arose that ODOT determined that on some of those places that we do that, they are state highways. They had some concerns with that. We came together with them on 2583, met with them, and came up with the language, as you see it, that they can support. With that, I'd like to turn this over to Bob here from Bob is the Livingston is the lobbyist for the Oregon State Firefighters Council. He's also a Salem firefighter.
Okay. Is there any opposition to the bill? Okay, then let's kind of we can work the bill if we move right along. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, just a couple more points about this. Senator, Representative / Leonard has done a good job of explaining this bill. Just a couple of highlights that I'd like to mention. In the history of the Fill the Boot program, there has never been an injury to a firefighter. Now with the amendments that we've worked with ODOT, you will not only have liability insurance, which MDA has covered for firefighters in the past, you also have to submit a safety plan. So going from an already safe practice to a safer practice is good. And I would just like to mention briefly that last year alone, the International Association of Firefighters, which is our parent group, raised over $12 million through the Fill the Boot campaign for these kids. And the people that go to these camps are really endeared to the firefighters and the work that they do. And we do have... We get a lot of pleasure out of it to the firefighters that do attend these camps, and it means an awful lot to them and to the kids and to the families of the people that have children that have MDA. And I'd also just like to mention for the record that the testimony that's provided in front of you, Patty Helzer, who is with the MDA, is the author of this that you have in front of you. And with that, I'll close my testimony.
You mentioned there's no fireman hurt. Has there been any car wreck?
Madam Chair, to my knowledge, I do not believe there's even been a car wreck in during that time, but for sure I cannot answer absolutely there's
okay.
Never been a car wreck.
Okay, go ahead.
Madam Chair and the rest of the committee here, I'm Cal Eddy. I've been doing the Fill the Boot out on the street for over 25 years now, and this is something that we've been looking forward to try to put together and do a right way, put it across. I'm really proud of being a firefighter, and I'm proud of what we do. We're here not to ask for ourselves, but for the kids. We're not selfish, and I want to say again, I'm really proud of it.
Great. I'm sure you're not. Oh, okay, any questions?
Senator Yee. For the panel, for Representative Randy Leonard.
This is my page.
So you can raise $12 million from the event. How long a period is it?
That's actually nationwide, that occurs throughout the United States, and it occurs over the period.
Yeah, let me answer that question, because I was fortunate to go down to the national telephone as a representative of the firefighters, and it across the nation, it's unreal how they do it. Anchorage, Alaska raised $28,000 in 3 hours. They do it on the street. Florida, they've been through this same process. We're doing it right now. Texas has been through it. They raised Houston, Texas raises $400,000 in a weekend. Baltimore, when I went to this thing, I was really proud, but I hung my head down because we made such a small amount compared to everybody else. And maybe by this, if you guys can support us, we can boost it back up.
I mean, is this a week, a weekend, a whole month?
Labor Day weekend is the main focal point, but sometimes they do it the week before or something, you know. But Labor Day weekend across the nation, and if you've ever traveled during that time, you go to Spokane or something, you'll get stopped by firefighters.
Another question, Madam Chair. So was there ever any injury or accident across the nation when you do it near highways?
I know of none at this. That's not. I know of none that has happened.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. That's it. Okay. Ken Armstrong and Doug Kendall. Is Ken here? I saw him.
Well, I'll be brief.
Good.
Chair Shannon, members of the committee, Doug Kendall, maintenance engineer from the Oregon Department of Transportation. House Bill 2583 changes a statute that currently solicitation is prohibited on state highways. And 2583 allows solicitation by firefighters with the safety plan, with insurance, for charitable causes. And it's, I really appreciate having the chance to work with the muscular dystrophy people, with the firefighters, and with Representative Leonard to craft language that will allow this to happen safely. Thank you.
I have a question. Has any other group ever asked you to help like this, allow them to do something?
Chair Shannon, there's been a lot of people that have asked us to sell things on the highway, and we've always gone back to that statute to prohibit solicitation and said, no, you can't do that. This is the first time, I believe, that it's gone to changing the statute.
This time you met up with the legislator. Okay, any other questions? Okay, thank you. We will. And just for the record, Ken Armstrong with the Oregon Fire Chiefs Association has signed up. They support the bill also. So we're going to close public hearing on House Bill 2583A, open a work session on 25.
Schrader wants.
Do I see him? Representative Schrader. No, it's another bill. House Bill 25, opening a work session.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move House Bill 2583A as to the floor with a due pass.
Is that an amendment?
No.
No amendment.
If the other people would have been here, we could have considered it. But. Okay, is there any discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Senator Keel?
Aye.
Senator George?
Aye.
Senator Yates?
Aye.
Chair Shannon?
Aye. Having received unanimous vote, it will go to the House Bill 2583A will go to the floor of the due pass recommendation, and would you like to carry it? Okay. And Senator George will carry the bill. Thank you. Okay. And because, just for those that, thanks, okay, Senator Leonard. What we tried to do, because Representative, no, I'm talking about Schrader, but that's okay, I mean, Representative Schrader, we try to have the representatives come so that you get back to their committee, speak when they come. So I'm going to open a public hearing
on House Bill 2841A, and would you explain the bill?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2841A changes the population threshold for cities allowed to withdraw from mass transit districts, allows cities with fewer than 15,000 persons to withdraw, adjusts the filing schedule for withdrawal petitions to allow petitions for withdrawal in 2001 and every 6 years thereafter. But then it returns the population threshold to 10,000 on December 31st.
Thank you. Welcome, Representative Schrader.
Thank you, Vanna, very much, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Representative Kurt Schrader, House District 23. I appreciate the opportunity to testify on House Bill 2841. It's a fairly straightforward bill, I think, as the committee administrator has alluded to. It just basically provides a temporary window of opportunity for a couple of the peripheral communities that are currently in TriMet to explore an option to develop their own transit district. Current law prohibits any community over 10,000 in population currently in TriMet from withdrawing from TriMet. Several communities on the edge of the borders outside of the metropolitan area and some within in past days, Wilsonville for one, Malala and Sandy most recently, have been able to opt out. Recently, TriMet's been cutting back service to some of the less productive peripheral lines. You see notices in the newspaper on this. Example would be Route 44 to King City, averaging only 8 riders per bus hour. Route 154 that goes from Oregon City to the Willamette neighborhood, averaging only 3 riders per bus hour. That's neither efficient nor profitable for TriMet, nor helpful for those communities. Community and business leaders in Canby have been concerned about the impact of growth in our area, the community, and the level of cost-effective service that TriMet can provide our community. Large buses are currently running with very limited hours on very limited routes in our town. The community has done some preliminary investigation and found that it may be possible to contract for service, current service level, for about half the cost. So they're very interested. On the other side of the things, Canby is also interested in expanding its service. We have a growing retirement community out there that is currently not served with the existing routes. I think you'll hear some testimony in a little bit from a couple members of the community about how we'd like to expand our service out there in a very cost-effective manner. My understanding, the TriMet has no plans to expand service for Canby in the current three-year planning period, and that they do not object to this bill. This bill does not guarantee that Canby gets out of the TriMet district. It merely allows them the opportunity to explore that with TriMet. We've talked with the members, some of the members of the board, and the head of TriMet, and they seem amenable for allowing us to make the case. Hopefully, the committee allows us to do so also, and would urge my vote. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Okay, well, I will call Bernie Bottomley. You want to come up, Bernie? And then after Bernie, we'll have Scott and Walt. Okay. I should say, Bernie, that I helped Senator Kintai when we were working together for Malala, but not Sandy, and it's worked very well in Wilsonville and Malala. So I was wondering what you...
Certainly has. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Bernie Bottomley, Legislative Director for TriMet. I just wanted to go on the record as saying that TriMet does not oppose this bill. We've had a good relationship with the city of Canby, and we look forward to having their application to withdraw from the district. Look forward to working with them on that application to try to find a solution that works for them. Appreciate Representative Schrader's assistance in amending the bill slightly so that some of our concerns about maintaining a regular schedule for doing these withdrawals is in place, and we look forward to working with them.
Okay, thanks, Bernie. Any questions? No. Okay, then, Scott Taylor, Mayor of Canby, and Walt Daniels, Council President. Thank you.
Chair Shannon, for the record, I'm Scott Taylor, Mayor of the City of Canby. Walt Daniels, Council President.
Okay.
Thank you very much. We'll be very brief.
Good. You'll get your bill.
We very much would like to do this. We see Canby as a community that could really improve our local transportation system and provide a greater opportunity. We're developing with businesses on all ends of town. We'd like to create an internal and an external loop out, and this bill would allow us to explore that and work with TriMet to make sure that our citizens can get to downtown Portland and back and perhaps increase our capabilities.
Senator Shannon and members of the committee, my name is Walt Daniels. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today.
I've been a counselor for 12 years in Canby and a businessman for 20 years in retail hardware. And transportation has always been a concern of mine as a businessman and an elected official. Why are we wanting relief from TriMet? We are in TriMet, we are not in Metro. I believe there are several reasons. The most important is that we need to improve our transportation service. We have not had service that is needed for our growing community. The TriMet schedules do not meet the needs of the worker who's working 9 to 5 in Portland or a college student who has late evening classes. We do even have late evening runs into Canby. Canby is a growing community with a large number of single-family homes, apartments, and Hope Village, which is retirement and assisted living. It's located 1 mile from downtown Canby and consists of 80 assisted living apartments, 50 low-income apartments, and 22 garden apartments, with additional 10 coming on soon. There is a van that gives limited services to operated by volunteers. The van is for doctor's appointments, making some shopping, and is operated on a fixed schedule. The adult center in Canby serves 77 meals a day, and there's only 18 riders that use the bus. With the building of Canby Market Center, approximately 3/4 mile from downtown, to be opened in 1999, 165,000 square foot Fred Meyer store and some 45,000 square foot of other goods services will be provided. This center is approximately to downtown, requires a car or public transportation. This is not feasible to walk too easy. We need more frequent transportation to avail ourselves of goods and services for the Canby market. Approximately 10% of the Canby's population are Latinos, and some of those people don't drive and they rely on walking to the grocery store. In 1996, 79.24% of the working population in Canby drove alone to work, and only 1.89% used public transportation. 51.45% of these spent 10 to 29 minutes travel time to work. With phase two of our industrial park and many manufacturers of Canby, workers could ride the bus if available and cut down auto traffic. This is becoming a big problem. Another factor is the growing senior population is reluctant to drive in congestion and resulted in a 5% annual growth. As a former businessman and present city councilor, I feel we need to address our transportation needs now. The problem is up to us now, and we have to have our hands tied. We've tried to get better service from TriMet, but no available. Now is the time we can give our citizens freedom to develop a transportation system which will fit the needs of the city of Canby. 5 years down the long road is too long to wait. Thanks for your time.
Senator George has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the territory that, because this does allow a certain area of territory to be withdrawn, what kind of taxes and fees are you folks paying right now?
To TriMet?
Yeah, to TriMet.
Senator George, right now, I'm told we pay $660,000 a year to TriMet.
I think that you're well on your way.
Okay. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Do you have to double your payroll tax to fund the system since you have less population?
Senator Shannon, Senator Yee, I'm not, what we believe from our experience with talking to Wilsonville, Malala, and Sandy is that actually the payroll tax could be reduced and we could have an increased bus service within the city.
Next
to the hub. Mm-hmm. We also had very, very preliminary conversations with the smart system that Wilsonville runs to see what our possibility of coordinating with them would be. So actually, we believe it will reduce the payroll taxes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you, Senator George.
One quick follow-up. Under the smart, they've been able to provide free service for basically the same amount of money they were paying before. Is that correct?
Chair Shannon, Senator George, I believe they've actually been able to do it for less.
For less?
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. Less than free?
Less than free.
You're getting it all free.
Okay. Thanks. We're going to close a public hearing on Health Bill 2841A, open a work session on Health Bill 2841A, and Senator George moves it to the floor with the due pass. Is there any discussion?
Good bill should pass.
Clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Having received the unanimous vote, we'll vote House Bill 2841A will go to the floor with a due pass and I will carry it. Thank you. Close, and then we'll close the work session on House Bill 2841A, and we're going to go back and finish. No more interruptions. Our hearing on House Bill 2071A. And thank you.
Mm.
once again, Chair Shannon, members of the committee, Mark Landauer with the City of Portland's Office of Government Relations. I've brought with me today Rob Birchfield, the Assistant City Traffic Engineer, along with Antoinette Sherman with the City's Office of Transportation, so that we can get into some of those technical questions that you may have regarding red light photo enforcement. Thank you.
Okay.
Would you like to answer your or pose your questions now or
sure the, no go ahead I mean, yeah, well, tell, walk us through because yeah, our concern work. My concern we haven't talked about it but my concern is how you really know that the car missed it didn't stop.
Very good.
Thank you. I'll try to answer that question for you. The technology that's used at a particular intersection consists of detection loops, which are in the pavement and permanently placed there. They're wired to the signal controller at the intersection, and then there's a camera mounted on a pole, which takes photographs of the offending vehicle. Some of the important details about how this operates is that there's a threshold. First, a vehicle has to be moving and entering the intersection when the light is red in order to be photographed. Those are the only vehicles that would be photographed. Typically, jurisdictions set that threshold at around 10 to 15 miles per hour. So if you were in the middle of an intersection waiting to turn left and you were sitting there and the light turned red, you would not be photographed or would have no risk of getting a citation in this case. The other threshold that's used is a slight time delay on when the vehicle enters the intersection, usually from 0.3 to 0.5 seconds after the light turns red. Is used as that threshold before a photograph would be taken. So one, the light has to already have been red, the vehicle has to be moving at an appreciable speed before they would be considered a red light violator and a photograph would be taken. When the photograph is taken, a series of photographs show the progress of the vehicle through the intersection. So it's not just one photograph, but it basically shows the time sequence of the vehicle running the red light through the intersection. There's a data field that's printed with the photograph that shows the time of day, the location, and all the pertinent data that's relevant to that particular offense. There were several questions about cost. Cost of the installation will probably vary depending on the local jurisdiction choices, but cameras themselves cost about $50,000 per camera. Most jurisdictions and most models that we see in other states are that jurisdictions are leasing those cameras from a vendor, and so that they don't pay that entire capital cost up front. And it also allows them, the vendors, to be essentially providing them with the services that go along with the technology, i.e. servicing the cameras, et cetera, so that the jurisdictions don't necessarily have to have all that expertise themselves in order to do that.
Is there any connection between how the vendor gets paid and the number of people who are photographed? Is there any payment that's tied to?
It depends entirely on the type of agreement that the city may have with the vendor. Some jurisdictions do have models where they're paid, at least part of the payment would be on a per citation basis, yes. Currently, that's the way our agreement with Photo Radar operates. It's based on, at least, it's tied to the number of citations in a broad sense. With red light running, there's likely to be a fixed cost that you have to pay the vendor, even if there are no citations, because the cost of having the cameras that sit are there and then servicing those. And then they may also have a per citation cost, but that really is tied to the cost of usually the services that have to do with processing the film and making the data available to the city so that the city can issue the citation.
So do you have any concerns about that, though, that there would be a motivation to, mean that if they're going to make money off of how many photographs they take, that presents a conflict of interest in any way?
Chair Shannon, Senator Castillo, actually, from the data that we've looked at, the
payment to the vendor generally correlates to the citation that has been paid for the infraction. So if so the camera is an automatic shutter speed here. They are paid tied to the fine that is sent back to the jurisdiction for that infraction.
Thank you. Okay, so Ms. George.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You described it as you guys, you folks began, that we have a permanently installed loop in the pavement. In that $50,000 cost, does that include the disruption of the road, repaving, everything that would be necessary to get all that in? Is that included in the $50,000?
No, actually, I didn't quite complete my cost summary. The cameras themselves would, the capital cost of the cameras is about $50,000. But the cost for the detection for a complete intersection, which includes the loops, the wiring, and all that, is approximately $25,000 per intersection. So it's not a trivial investment. And at least in the city of Portland, what we've looked at is we've gone out and done time-lapse videos to find locations where we have a very high rate of red light running. And we would only install these cameras, at least initially, at places where we had very high rates of red light running. We don't think it would be cost-effective to do it just anywhere.
Okay, so go ahead then.
Yep.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the $25,000 for the detection doesn't include installation?
It does include.
Okay. Is that a very big deal to disrupt the traffic and install this thing?
No, we do that routinely at any time we make, you know, signal modifications. To cut the loops is a very, you don't have to tear up the roadway. You just put a very small, you know, saw blade width slice in there and then backfill that with like a rubber cement.
Okay, and these costs then would be $75,000. Does that include all four directions at that intersection?
It would be really to cover two directions, I mean, like the main street. And actually, if you bought the cameras and you wanted both directions, you'd probably end up having two cameras. So it would be more than
$50,000 then per intersection.
Yeah. It could be the highest you paid all the cost up front for capital.
But I'm sorry, Chair Shannon, Senator George, Mark Landauer again. Once again, the capital cost of the camera, which is $50,000, which you're citing, is something that we would hope to probably lease once again rather than make an upfront $50,000 expenditure right off the bat.
I'm sure the only thing is there's no such thing as free money. That's we're going to charge
absolutely
interest on that.
Absolutely.
We want the maintenance.
Absolutely.
The other thing, could I do one more?
You can do as many as you
want. Okay. I have a photograph in my office that I took with my digital camera over in Beaverton of some sort of camera device. And this device had been vandalized. And it was clamped onto one of the poles alongside 217. Now, that may have been just an ODOT camera, but it had been seriously vandalized. In the preliminary tests that were done, did you have any people retaliate against these cameras? Because I can imagine that being extremely expensive to fix, because this camera got me, I'm going to get it.
Yeah,
that's
a good question.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Antoinette Sherman. There have been some cases of vandalization, which is why now the vendors offer bulletproof casings for the cameras. Of course, that's not going to stop someone if they are, you know, just dead set on destroying that camera. They could always pull it down with a rope in their car or something like that.
Okay,
thanks. Okay. Do you have a question, Senator
Yee? Well, I asked them for source of funding. So when you lease the whole thing, do you still have to give them monthly payments? And is this going to come from property tax or?
Again, it would depend on the city. In the city of Portland, our hope would be to get grant funding to cover the initial capital costs, which would be to put in the detection we would need for a number of test intersections. We would hope to have an agreement with a vendor that would allow the program to be essentially financed to at least to a break-even point by the violation, by the fine. Right now, that's basically the agreement we have. I mean, the type of arrangement we have with Photo Radar. We're losing some money on Photo Radar, but that's probably unique to Portland because we have a municipal court. I think other jurisdictions could probably run it with a break-even type arrangement if they get the right type of agreement with the vendors.
Actually, we're prohibited from having a municipal court in the city of Portland by statute. That creates a problem for us through the unitary assessment and so forth, how the money from a citation is divvied up to the state and the local jurisdiction.
Well, you don't have a municipal court.
That is correct.
We do not have a municipal court. Right now, when we, with photo radar, the state gets more money than we do per citation. So we end up, but we pay the full cost of the program. So we can't quite break even with photo radar. But it gets rather complex if you look at how the money all splits out. The violation amount is higher for red light running, so we can do it. We hope that we can break even. Again, it depends on when we actually sit down to negotiate with vendors and try to, you know, kind of deal with them.
Another question.
Sure.
So if you're going to get grant money, do you get it from ODOT or where do you get the grant?
Our first place we'd look for is some type of federal grant, maybe some type of law enforcement grant.
Mm-hmm. Not from ODOT.
Hadn't planned on asking, but if they offered, we'd probably ask.
I want to ask you a question. Is that the home rule that you have municipal court, or is that ORS?
It is actually ORS that prohibits cities above 300,000 in population from having a municipal court. And Senator, I have not looked into the history of why we are prohibited from doing or from having a municipal court, but if I can dig up that information, we'll be happy to
prove it. Well, we can amend.
we would certainly ask that we have an opportunity to review whether we want to have a municipal court first.
Okay. Senator Castillo.
Thank you. I was wondering how many times these types of citations that are done by PAMRA are contested, and what the rate is of people challenging whether they ran a red light or not once this photograph has been taken.
I'm going to try to answer that to the best of my ability. I don't think we know for sure. Our best experience, at least, would be looking at photo radar, where there's been some challenges, but very few by proportion, and very few that have been really successful challenging the technology. I think that's not been a problem. It's convincing evidence because the photograph of the driver can be produced as part of the evidence.
One more quick one. You see these new license plate covers, and I noticed that 40 states prohibit this photo radar. And so you wonder if it is because of somebody's quick technology. But I could see a subtle louver set at an angle that would just about relate to that sort of thing, that the license plate could be read by a police officer, but not by that machine. You know what I'm talking about. Some existing covers right now would almost make it impossible for the glare to establish the number. So what do? You just let those guys go by? Because the person who's going to blow through stop signs is going to be looking for that kind of option, just like they buy a little radar detector.
Well, to my knowledge, this is something I've discussed with Captain Nelson. We haven't found anything out there that works yet. And, of course, we'll be interested to see if someone comes up with something, but that, to date, that has not been a problem with photo radar, and we don't expect it would be with red light running.
We have actually asked our vendor to check into these license plate covers that have been marketed out there as a defense against these cameras, and to my understanding, nothing is being marketed, that would prevent us from being able to read the license plate at this point.
Yeah, let's just say nothing's being marketed with a money-back guarantee.
Okay, what about at night? Is the street light enough light?
There's actually a flash associated with the camera. And so it's something that it's visible. You would notice a flash. It's very brief, and it doesn't cause any problems in terms of driving. But the flash is sufficient to illuminate the vehicle and the driver, and take a photograph that can be processed and used as evidence.
Okay. Did you want to add something?
Well,
yeah, come on. You have to identify yourself.
Okay. My name's Jared Clark, City of Houston. Okay. I know the City of Houston does not operate photo radar, which also has a flash at night, and I think we'd probably use the same policy and not activate the cameras in the evening.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So you just do it in the daytime?
That's been our policy with photo radar, and I think it for us it just eliminates any question of a flash.
Okay. Are there any other questions? Wait, yes.
Do you have a picture we can look at to see what it really shows?
We can provide you with some examples of that. We don't have them here today, but I'm sure Mark would be happy to get those for you.
Madam Chair, I understand that it's going to show the red light showing the red color and the driver's image and the license plate too. So I just want to see if it shows all three of those items.
We'll be happy to provide that to you and the members of the committee.
Okay. Does anyone have anything else for the good of the order that you think you've left out? Okay. Thank you. Then.
Thank you.
We'll close the public hearing for House Bill 2071A. This does have a referral to judiciary, but I'm not going to work the stage because I'm thinking about amending it.
Oh, no, I'm sending it to judiciary.
Not today. It's not listed as a work session. You can do it next week, yeah?
Yeah, I
can get a couple minutes for the time. Me too. Okay, is there any other business before
you? Any given time to show us.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Let's see. I think everything's just on regular schedule next week, so thank you for your...
Thanks.
Okay. Well,
then?
Yes. We'll close the Senate Transportation Committee.